But what about my job, old boy? Can't just drop everything and walk away. Do you enjoy your job that much? Mark asked softly. Does peddling motor cars feed your soul? Hey, Dickie began to look uncomfortable. It's not a case of enjoying it. I mean, nobody really enjoys having to work, do they? I mean, it's just something one does, you know. One's lucky to find something one can do reasonably well, where one can earn an honest coin, and one does it. I wonder, Mark mused. Tell me, Dickie, what is most important, the coin or the good feeling down there in your guts? Dickie stared at him, his lower jaw sagging slightly, exposing a mouthful of half-masticated rice. Out there I felt clean and tall, Mark went on, fiddling with his beer stein. There were no bosses, no clients, no hustling for a commission. I don't know, Dickie. Out there I felt important. Important? Dickie swallowed the unchewed curry noisily. Important? Hey now, old boy. They're selling rakes like you and me on the street corners at Nightpence a bunch. He washed down the rice with a swallow of beer and then patted the froth from his upper lip with the crisp white handkerchief from his breast pocket. Take an old dog's advice. When you say your prayers at night, give thanks that you're a good motor car salesman and that you've found that out. Just do it, old son, and don't think about it or it'll break your heart. He spoke with an air of finality that declared the subject closed and stooped to open his briefcase on the floor beside his chair. Here, I've something for you. There were a dozen thick letters in Marion Littlejohn's neat feminine hand, all in blue envelopes, a colour which she had explained in previous letters indicated undying love. There was also an account for a disputed 12 and 6p, which his tailor insisted Mark had underpaid, and there was another envelope of marbled paper, pale beige and watered expensively, with Mark's name blazoned across it in a peremptory, arrogant hand, and no address. Mark singled it out and turned it over to examine the crest, thickly crusted in heavy embossing that stood out on the flap. Dickie watched him open it, and then leaned forward to read it unashamedly. But Mark saved him the effort and flipped it across to him. "Regimental dinner," he explained. "You'll just make it," Dickie pointed out. "Friday the 16th. Then his voice changed, imitating a regimental sergeant major. 2 hours sharpish, dress formal, and RS bloody VP. Take your dressing from the right, you lucky blighter. Your guinea has been paid by your colonel-in-chief, Lord Muckamuck General Courtney, his exalted self. Off you go, my boy, drink his champagne and steal a handful of cigars. Up the workers, say I." "I think I'll give it a miss," murmured Mark, and placed Marion's letters in his inside pocket to prevent Dickie reading those also. "You've gone bush crazy. The sun touched you, old boy," Dickie declared solemnly. "Think of those 300 potential owners of Cadillacs sitting around one table, pissed to the wide, and smoking free cigars. Captive audience. Whip around the table and peddle them a Cadillac each while they're still stunned by the speeches." "Were you in France?" Mark asked. "Not France," Dickie's expression changed. "Palestine, Gallipoli, and such like sunny climes." The memory darkened his eyes. "Then you'll know why I don't feel like going up to the old fort to celebrate the experience," Mark told him. And Dickie Lancome studied him across the loaded table. He had made himself a judge of character, of men and their workings. He had to be a good judge to be a good salesman, so he was surprised that he had not recognised the change in Mark sooner. Looking at him now, Dickie knew that he had acquired something, some new reserve of strength and resolution, the likes of which few men gathered about them in a lifetime. Suddenly he felt a humility in Mark's presence, and although it was tinged with envy, the envy was without rancour. Here was a man who was going somewhere, to a place where he would never be able to follow, a path that needed a man with a lion's liver to tread. He wanted to reach across the table and shake Mark's hand and wish him well on the journey. But instead he spoke quietly, dropping the usual light and cavalier facade. "I wish you'd think about it, Mark. General Courtney came to see me himself." And he went on to tell him of the visit, of Sean Courtney's anger when he had heard that Mark had been discharged at his daughter's behest. "He asked for you to be there especially, Mark, and he really meant it." Mark showed his invitation at the gates and was passed through the massive stone outer fortifications. There were fairy lights strung in the trees along the pathway that led through the gardens of the old fort, giving the evening a frivolous carnival feeling at odds with the usual atmosphere this bastion had known from the earliest British occupation, through siege and war with Dutch and Zulu, many of the Empire's warriors who had paused there on their occasions. There were other guests ahead of him and behind him on the pathway, but Mark avoided them, feeling self-conscious in the dinner jacket he had hired from the pawnbroker when he retrieved his decorations. The garment had the venerable greenish tinge of age and was ventilated in places by the ravages of moths. It was too tight across the shoulders and too full in the belly, and it exposed too much cuff and sock. But when he had pointed this out to the pawnbroker, the man had asked him to finger the pure silk lining and had reduced the hire fee to 5 shillings. Miserably, he joined the file of other dinner-jacketed figures on the steps of the drill hall, and when his turn came, he stepped up to the reception line. "So," said General Sean Courtney, "you came." The craggy features were suddenly boyish, as he took Mark's hand, in a grip that felt like tortoiseshell, cool and hard and calloused. He stood at the head of the reception line like a tower, broad and powerful, resplendent in immaculately cut black and crisp starch white, with a gaudy block of silk ribbons and enamel crosses and orders across his chest. With a twitch of an imperial eyebrow, he summoned one of his staff. "This is Mark Anders," he said. "You remember the old firm of Anders and MacDonald, 1st Brigade?"
"Indeed, sir."
The officer looked at Mark with quick interest, his eye dropping from his face to the silk ribbons on his lapel and back to his face.
"Now you look after him," said General Courtney. And then to Mark, "Get yourself a drink, son, and I'll talk to you later."
He released Mark's hand and turned to the next in line. But such was the magnetism and charm of the big man that after the brief contact and the few gruff words, Mark was no longer the gawky stranger, callow and awkward in cast-off clothes, but an honoured guest worthy of special attention. The subaltern took his charge seriously and led Mark into the dense crowd of black-clad males, all of them still subdued and self-conscious in their unaccustomed finery, standing in stiff knots, although the waiters moved among them, bearing silver trays laden with the regiment's hospitality. "A whiskey, is it?" asked the subaltern, and picked a glass from one of the trays. "All liquid refreshment tonight is with the general's compliments," and took another glass for himself. "Cheers! Now let's see. 1st Brigade." And he looked around. "You must remember Hooper or Dennison?" He remembered them and others, dozens of them. Some were vaguely familiar features, just shades at the edge of his memory. But others he knew well and liked or disliked and even hated. With some he had shared food or passed a cigarette butt back and forth. With others he had shared moments of terror or exquisite boredom. The good ones, the workers, the cowards, and the shirkers and the bullies were all there. And the whiskey came endlessly on silver trays. They remembered him also. Men he had never seen in his life came up to him. "You remember me? I was a section leader at Darcy Wood when you and MacDonald..." And others. "Are you the Anders? I thought you'd be older somehow. Your glass is empty." And the whiskey kept coming on the silver trays. And Mark felt tall and clever, for men listened when he talked, and witty, for men laughed when he jested. They sat at a table that stretched the full length of the hall and was covered with a damask cloth of dazzling white. The regimental silver blinked like heliographs in the candlelight, and now it was champagne cascading into crystal glass in showers of golden bubbles. All around the comradely uproar of laughter and of raised voices, and each time Mark lowered his glass, there was a turbaned figure at his side and a dark hand poising the green bottle over his glass. He sagged back in his chair with his thumbs hooked in his armpits and a black cigar sticking a foot out of his mouth.
"Here, hearing and quite writing,"
the after-dinner speakers, as owlish and wise as the best of them, exchanging knowledgeable nods of agreement with his neighbours while the ruby port smouldered in his glass. When the general rose from his centre seat at the cross-piece of the table, there was an audible stir in the company, which had become heavy and almost somnolent with port and long meandering speeches. They grinned at each other now in anticipation, and though Mark had never heard Sean Courtney speak, he sensed the interest and recharged enthusiasm, and he sat up in his chair. The general did not disappoint them. He started with a story that left them stunned for a moment, gasping for breath,
before they could bellow with laughter. Then he went at them in a relaxed, easy manner that seemed casual and natural, but using words like a master swordsman using a rapier, a jest, an oath, a solid piece of good sense, something they wanted to hear, followed immediately by something that disturbed them, singling out individuals for praise or gentle censure. "Third this year in the National Polo Championships, gentlemen, an honour which the regiment carried easily last year. But a certain gentleman seated at this board has chosen to ride for the sugar planters now, a decision which it is his God-given right to make, and which I am certain not one of us here would condemn," said Sean Courtney. And he paused, grinning evilly, and smoothing his whiskers, while the entire company booed raucously and hammered the table with their dessert spoons. The victim flushed to vivid scarlet and squirmed in the cacophony. "However, good news and great expectations for the Africa Cup this year. By dint of adroit sleuthing, it has been discovered that dwelling in our very midst," and the next moment the entire hall was slapping palm to palm, a great thunder of sound, and heads were craning down to Mark's end of the table, while the general nodded and beamed at him, and when Mark slumped down quickly in his seat and tried to make his lanky frame fold like a carpenter's ruler, Sean Courtney called, "Stand up, son, let them get a good look at you." Mark rose uncertainly and bobbed his head left and right, and not until later did it occur to him that he had been skilfully manoeuvred into accepting their applause, that in doing so he was committed. It was the first time he witnessed, from a front-row seat, the general handling the destiny of a man and achieving his object without apparent effort. He was pondering this, a little muzzily, as he steered for the safe base of the next lamp-post. It would, of course, have been wiser and safer to accept the offer made to him by one of the rickshaw drivers at the gates of the fort, when he had reeled out into the street 2 hours after midnight. However, his recent unemployment and extravagant expenditure on fancy clothing had left him no choice as to his means of transport. He faced now a walk of some 3 miles in the dark, and his progress was erratic enough to make it a long journey. He reached the lamp-post and braced himself just as a black Rolls-Royce stopped beside him and the back door swung open. "Get in," said the general, and as Mark tumbled ungracefully into the soft leather seat, an iron grip steadied him. "You are not a drinking man," it was a statement, not a question, and Mark had to agree. "No, sir." "You've got a choice," said the general. "Learn or leave it alone completely." Sean had waited for almost half an hour, the Rolls parked under the banyan trees, for Mark to appear through the gates, and he had been on the point of abandoning the evening and giving his driver the order to return to Emoyeni, when Mark had tottered out into the street, brushed away the importunate rickshaw drivers, and set off like a crab along the pavement, travelling further sideways than forward. The Rolls had crept silently along behind him, with the headlights dark, and Sean Courtney had watched with a benevolent smile the young man's erratic progress. He felt a gentle indulgence for the lad and for himself, for the odd little quirks and whims with which he still surprised himself occasionally. At 62 years of age, a man should know himself, know every strength and be able to exploit it, know every weakness and have built a secure buttress against it. Yet here he was, for no good reason that he could fathom, becoming more and more emotionally involved with a young stranger, spending time and thought for he was not sure what end. Perhaps the boy reminded him of himself at the same age. And now he thought about it, he did detect beneath the warm glow of champagne in his belly the nostalgia for that troubled time of doubt and shining ambition when a boy stood on the threshold of manhood. Perhaps it was that he admired. No, cherished was a better word. Cherished, special quality in any animal. A fine horse, a good dog, a young man. That excellence that horsemen might call blood, or a dog handler, class. He had detected it in Mark Anders, and as even a blood horse might be damaged by bad handling or a class dog spoiled, so a young man who had the same quality needed advice and direction and opportunity to develop his full capability. There was too much mediocrity and too much dross in this world, Sean thought, so that when he found class, he was drawn strongly to it. Or perhaps again, and suddenly he felt that terrible black wave of mourning sweep over him. Or perhaps it is simply that I do not have a son.